Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's July 8th, 2010, and I'm glad you can join us. I'm coming to you from the City of London. If you were listening to Franklin and I talk as we're coming up on the hour, I've just spent the last couple of hours in the streets of London. There was a fire in Liverpool Station, and so the smoke came into the hotel. We had to empty out the hotel, so I've just spent a couple hours with bankers from all around the world talking about the markets. It's been quite fascinating. And I must say, it caused my theme for this evening, which is You Never Know. And my hero of the evening are the London Bobbies, because they are remarkable at crowd control under what could be very difficult and tense situations. It was quite impressive to watch them operate. They were all amazingly charming as everybody got more and more frustrated with the situation. So there it is. Tonight, great guest, James Turk, is going to join Franklin and me. But first, Money and Markets. No, ask Catherine. I'm going to put all the questions into precious metals for James and Franklin. But let's just start with Money and Market. I came over, I wanted to report, I flew over leaving Wednesday, and I stopped on the way to the airport into the Apple store, as I had this weekend, trying to, one, get an appointment to see a specialist about an iPad, and then also, and literally couldn't get an appointment, it was so packed, and then tried to pick up an adapter on the way to the airport, and it was boom times, it was amazing. There was a new recession, and both the Memphis airport, the DFW airport flights were packed. Same thing in London, coming into London today, this morning, and you would have no idea that there was any possibility of a recession, just looking at the crowds and the activity, so it's quite interesting. That's one view of the thing. If you look at what's happening with unemployment in the States, I mentioned last week the Pew survey showing 50% of working adults have been affected by the downturn, whether lower income, working fewer hours, working part-time, working at lower wages, or unemployed. And of course, the decision not to renew the long-term unemployment benefits is going to have a big impact. The criticality of local revenues, state and local revenues, is becoming more and more widely understood. There's an excellent video from Meredith Whitney that I posted up on the blog talking about the percent of global of GNP coming from state and local government. We have a report also up on the blog this week that Illinois has stopped paying essential bills. That's very scary. And now finally people in the municipal bond market are starting to pick up on the fact that the kind of uncertainties we're watching globally in the sovereign bond market apply to state and local government. Now, that's all what's going on in the fixed income markets are spilling into the equity markets. There was a big IPO for the China Agricultural Bank. Fascinating situation. I put up a big report from The Economist on the blog about emerging market banks. It's interesting to see just the sheer size of the Chinese banks and their role in the emerging market. So that was an important IPO, and lots of spin this week sort of trying to make China look good. Another spin trying to make someone look good, BP is searching for an investor, and it has been remarkable, the good news being promoted on the relief wells. Again, for those of you who heard Jim Norman's interview on the Gulf oil spill, his prediction was that these two relief oil wells probably had about a 50% chance of working. But to read the press, you wouldn't think so. Another damper on the equity markets, we're watching the markets try and grapple with financial reform. What does it mean? You know, you feel it over here, the real concern with increased regulation of the United States over foreign financial institutions and investment vehicles, a real concern. I was talking, in fact, with an Australian banker while we sat in the streets, and who said literally there's no one buying equity globally. And I said to him, well, you know, it's very hard to buy when it's not a market, when it's a battle zone. Needless to say, though, the China Bank IPO deal did get done. As I said last week, the financial reform bill is going to be very tough on community banks. So, and that in turn is going to be tough on small business. So remember, if you bank locally, it's very, very important that you have a bank that is well-governed and well-managed. If you're interested, the bank local section or the bank intimate section of the Salera website has a good piece on how to find a good local bank. But now's the time to make sure you're in a strong one, because the weak ones are going to have real increased regulatory and compliance expenses coming out of this. I continue to get great reports of people switching from the big banks to the small banks, and I continue to encourage you to do that, because everything we can to shift into the smaller institutions that don't have derivatives, I recommend. One of the things that's coming from the financial reform bill, we have a report this week that non-financial firms are now looking at having to post significant capital on collateral for their derivative positions, which are used in the natural course of hedging. And it's a perfect example of the difficulty of trying to work out the complexity of some of these arrangements on a very centralized basis. It's not surprising. One of the headlines this week in Europe is that the European Union is delegating back the responsibility for regulating genetically modified food to the states. It's literally a perfect example of the dangers and the challenges of trying to deal with a highly complex issue, and an important issue on a centralized basis in an entity that is really not accountable or responsible and cannot relate to the constituents in a positive way. So, what's going to come out of the implementation, we don't know. We'll see what happens in mid-July, if it passes. We're planning on doing a special Salera report on it, and literally haven't started because we're still trying to nail down a document that is accurate as to what is in and what is not in. A very interesting editorial that was picked up in the International Herald Tribune from the New York Times, William Cohen has written about the bailouts and the financial situation, wrote an editorial basically saying the bad news is essentially, and he was targeting Goldman Sachs, that Goldman Sachs got away with everything. The good news after financial reform is that they'll have to give up their holding company and access to the federal credit. I would argue that they still have enormous backdoor access to the federal credit without the FDIC insurance provided by the holding company. And then he's saying the next time, then they'll be allowed to go down and they won't be too big to fail, which is just not the case. So unfortunately, it's more than clear that the process of the last, or sort of the financial fraud of the last 5 to 10 years has been remarkably successful. And I think the message of the financial reform is they got away with it. Now, all indications are Wall Street's not feeling that way. The reports are that fundraising for the Democrats is way down, because Wall Street is not donating money after the pain of financial reform and the bringing the complaint against Goldman Sachs and others. It was interesting on the BP situation. As I drove in from the airport today in London, the cab driver wanted to impress upon me how angry the British are at President Obama, because he keeps referring to BP as British Petroleum. And he pointed out that since Halliburton was involved, and Halliburton is a dirty player, this probably isn't BP's fault. It was very interesting. But you could tell there's tremendous tension over what has happened here, and you can feel it. So I wanted to mention in the last precious metals market report, Franklin and I recommend or review depository options for those people who want to buy physical precious metals, but for a variety of reasons don't want to hold that amount at home or hold any at home. And what we did was, after that report, we wrote up a special report that we've posted for subscribers only. It's at your, the subscriber control panel. I continue to feel that one of the reasons that many investors turn to the exchange-traded funds is because the depository options are complex and new to many investors and savers. And so we're hoping that report makes the options a little bit more understandable and some of the issues a little bit more understandable. And so it's another reason why I'm delighted tonight that James Turk could join us. James is really a very extraordinary person. I posted at the blog post a link to his bio, and I'm not going to describe his many credentials and long experience in the financial markets and in precious metals. But suffice it to say, and I wanted to first ask Franklin to join me, because Franklin, I want to ask you if I ever told you the story of how I met James Turk.
No.
Okay. This is a true story. This is trivia. In 1977, when I was interviewing for summer jobs at Wharton, James Turk interviewed me for a summer job at Chase.
You've come a long way, baby.
I've come a long way. So has James. But I re-met James through GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and the wonderful work that Bill Murphy does, and through Le Metropole Cafe. And then I had the opportunity to speak with him in London in both 2001 and 2002. And every time I hear James speak, I get, you know, I have one of these paradigm shifting epiphanies. But it was in London in 2001 when he said, you know, for 500 years we've been on a central banking warfare model. Many of you on the Solari Report have heard me refer to the central banking warfare model. And I have to tell you, I completely pilfered that from James. It was a brilliant, brilliant insight. And so I came to really respect him. I was very excited about what he was doing at Gold Money. And then I forget it. I think it was about 2003. He said to me, you know, there's this fellow in Tennessee named Franklin Sanders who's quite special. You really need to go meet him. And so I think you know, Franklin, it was James Turk who put me on to you. And of all the things I have to thank James Turk for, one is the opportunity to meet and get to know you.
Well, I'll have to thank him for the same thing.
Okay. Well, James, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Catherine. Hi, Franklin.
Hey, Dan.
Well, one of the things that Franklin and I grapple with is we do the Precious Metals Market Report and the Solari Report once a month, and that is really what is happening in the supply and demand of gold. And, of course, gold is becoming, and I guess it always has been, but you can really see it becoming an alternative currency globally. And so, you know, you are right at the heart. I know Gold Money, and I have to congratulate you, just passed $1 billion in holdings. Am I not correct?
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, over $1 billion of customer assets. And, you know, we're continuing to grow. We had another good month this month. And, you know, our sights are on, you know, larger numbers down the road, as long as we can continue to provide a product that our customers want. And so far we seem to be meeting that need. I think the prospects for Gold Money are quite good.
Now, what do you see as driving the supply and demand globally for gold?
Well, there are a couple things. You know, first of all of the problems with the monetary system and banking system worldwide, you know, that is causing people to actually look at the precious metals, gold as well as silver, in ways that they haven't done, you know, since the 1970s. But within that overall view, or within that overall movement of looking at the metals, there's something that's more important. It's subtle, and it started about a year ago, and that's where people are actually recognizing that there's a difference between owning physical gold and paper gold. When you own paper gold, you don't really own gold. You just own exposure to the gold price. And that exposure comes with counterparty risk. In other words, some banks or some companies or some funds promise that they will, you know, make good on your gain if the gold price goes up on the particular product that you own. It's a financial asset, paper gold. A physical gold, though, is a tangible asset. And because it is a tangible asset, it doesn't have counterparty risk. And in an environment where promises are becoming increasingly questioned, you know, people are trying to avoid counterparty risk. And the tipping point in this regard occurred last summer. There was a big New York hedge fund called Greenlight Capital, which up until that moment in time had been one of the largest shareholders of GLD, the big gold ETF that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange. They made an announcement just about a year ago that they had switched out of GLD into physical metal. They didn't explain why they did it, but it got everybody sort of looking at what the difference between paper gold and physical gold was, And it sort of led to a stampede of people moving out of paper into physical. And I think this stampede is going to continue, particularly as more and more people are drawn to the precious metals market anyway.
Well, how much of that, though, is the wholesale market, the central banks and the institutions as opposed to retail? Because from what I'm seeing, the growth of exchange-traded funds, not just here but globally, is very significant.
Yeah, it is. The problem with the exchange-traded funds, though, Catherine, is you don't really know how much physical gold they really have holding, supporting the shares. Because at the end of the day, they just don't do an independent third-party audit to actually prove that the physical gold exists. This has been the same issue that, I've raised, since the first ETF came out several years ago. And they've done a lot in order to make it a little bit more transparent than what it had been in the past. But there's a fundamental flaw in GLD and all of these other ETFs. It's that the Bank of England is the clearinghouse for all trading done on the London Bullion Market. And the Bank of England does not allow auditors into the Bank of England to actually look at how much gold is in the vault. So you have to use the Bank of England as a subcustodian, and if you use the Bank of England as a subcustodian, you can never have an independent third-party audit of how much gold really exists in GLD or any of the other ETFs that use the London clearing, that do their London clearing for gold through the Bank of England. So it's a bit of a fatal flaw in the way GLD is designed, and they haven't been able to come to grips with that. They can't.
Right,
do
I think
that.
Franklin and I agree with you. From what I'm seeing, the volume, we continue to see GLD continues to see huge growth in investor interest.
That's the thing that bothers me more than anything else. It's the Fort Knox of all these ETFs, and the problem with Fort Knox is the problem that appeared in the movie Goldfinger, if you remember that. The plot in Goldfinger was not to steal the gold in Fort Knox, but to make it radioactive and therefore unusable. And the problem with GLD is that it's become such a significant part of the market. It has more gold reserves. Last I saw, it had enough gold to make it, if it were a country, the fifth largest reserve holder in the world. Now, the problem with that is that when you have any market that's dominated by one buyer seller, you have a potential problem just in itself, just by the fact that there's so much dominance by that one huge buyer and seller. I mean, how do we know they're doing, as James says, how do we know they're doing what they say they're doing in the first place? But I also see it as a problem that you've got that much gold concentrated in a few hands.
Well, I try and track the premiums in the physical market versus, someone like Central Fund versus the ETFs GLD. And if you look at the premiums in the physical market versus Central Fund versus GLD, then the market clearly doesn't think that GLD is fully or properly collateralized because they're trading at a discount to melt value.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But they keep growing. And James, I don't know if you remember, but when I published the article, we published the disclosure in the precious metals puzzle palace, I guess it was called, and basically tried to describe why, one, we thought GLD was not a sound investment, but two, we thought the parties involved were using that precious metals to help manipulate the market. And and I was impressed by the response to the article that GLD just kept growing dramatically sort of every week after we published it. So it still surprises me, and my concern is we're watching new ETFs created sort of for the Asian market, and the same thing, a real pressure to get retail investment, not buying physical. And what one of my questions for you is the institutional market staying smart and doing the physical?
Yes, absolutely. You've seen the increased activity in Switzerland particularly. And a lot of the institutions are saying that gold deposits or gold accounts or gold custody, I should say, in Switzerland has become the new Swiss bank account, in a post-UBS environment. You know, it's the only thing where institutions and, you know, wealthy families can own a large amount of wealth in Switzerland without, you know, various governments and tax authorities, you know, actually having a look at what's involved. So, you know, gold has
now
become a currency. It's become, you know, like a new alternative to the Swiss franc.
Gold money, you can deposit in the UK, Switzerland, and now Hong Kong. Is that correct?
Yeah, we don't use the word deposit, though, because we're not a bank.
Right.
You store gold in the UK, Zurich, or Hong Kong. We're going to be adding additional vaults as we continue to go in the future in order to give our customers more geographic diversification. Because the biggest risk of holding gold these days, in my view, is the political risk. And the best way to mitigate political risk is to have your physical metal distributed in as many different locations as possible, different political jurisdictions as possible.
Now, from a market standpoint, what are the locations you find the market feels the most secure with?
Well, you know, Switzerland, in my view, is still very secure. It's still the major bullion market, you know, clearing in Zurich, or what's called the Zurich Free Trade Area. London is second in size to Switzerland, but, you know, London has lost a lot of its allure in recent years because of some decisions that were made by Gordon Brown using terrorist laws to seize Icelandic assets. Sort of put Britain on a slippery slope of, you know, destroying or eroding property rights, and that's made a lot of people nervous. You know, having lived in Asia for most of the 1970s, I've always found Hong Kong to be a great place to do business. I think, you know, Hong Kong is a very, very good alternative. Again, it's a different political system, but it's still based on traditional Anglo-Saxon common law, you know, the basis of which are property rights. So Switzerland is still number one, but, you know, I think Hong Kong is giving London a good run for its money. And I think that will continue to happen, continue to evolve in that way.
And what kind of preference is there? Gold money offers a certain kind of liquidity with your holdings that most other storage facilities don't. And
yes.
How important is that liquidity you find to what you're doing?
The liquidity is important to our customers. And the liquidity in Zurich, London, and Hong Kong are essentially equivalent. They're very, very deep markets, and you can transact in size, you know, fairly easily, both for gold as well as for silver.
Right. And you, one of the questions we have is today is, let me just read it. If the gold markets are manipulated, as GATA shows, how can playing the gold-silver ratio be a reliable investment strategy? Wouldn't that ratio be manipulated as well de facto? Franklin and I talk a lot on the Sawyer Report about trading the gold-silver ratio. Is that something that you're, that people with holdings at gold money have been doing? Is that something that happens at gold money?
Yeah, it is something that people do in gold money because it's one of the few ways in which you can actually trade physical gold against physical silver. You know, moving out of physical silver into physical gold or moving in, or vice versa, out of physical gold back into silver, depending on which one you want the ratio.
Okay. Well, you know, Franklin and I are very partial to keeping it at home, but if you see where we live, you would understand why.
Yeah, no, I'm partial to having some of it at home as well. And I, you know, since my Middle East days when I lived in Abu Dhabi, actually even before when I lived in Asia, I always carried a little bit of gold in my pocket. And what I presently carry are some small gold bars that I bought at the National Bank of Abu Dhabi, back in the mid-1980s. So, you know, I do recommend having physical gold at hand. There are advantages to doing that. There are also disadvantages. And if you want to have basically a large amount of precious metals to diversify your portfolio, you know, how much are you willing to put at risk of theft when you actually store at home? Yeah, so
right.
What you basically have to do is when you buy physical metal, there are only two ways to do it. You know, you buy it and you store it in yourself, or you buy it and have someone store it for you, which is what we do in gold money. And both alternatives have advantages and disadvantages, and you just have to look at which one works for you. I actually recommend that people, you know, have some physical metal at home, but also consider having physical metal outside of their home country stored for them elsewhere. The only thing I would caution is if you do use a service to store your metal, make sure they have the same types of governance procedures that we use, the most important which is the independent third-party audits to prove that the metal you own really does exist and is sitting there in the vault safe and secure for you.
One of the questions I get a lot, I'm sure Franklin gets it, is
definitely,
how do I know that whatever facility I'm using really checks to make sure that the metal is authentic?
Yeah, that gets into this third-party independent audits again. When I joined Chase and Hatton Bank, which is the first place that I worked when I graduated from college back in the 1960s, and went through the training program, one of the first things we learned was a big scandal that occurred back just a couple of years before I joined the bank, called the De Angelis Solid Oil Scandal. And what it was this guy, Tino De Angelis, had these tanks all over the country supposedly filled with solid oil. But as it turned out, the tanks were full of water with only an inch of solid oil on the top of them. So when you opened up the top, it seemed like solid oil, but it really wasn't. And what we learned in that training program was that you always had to do independent third-party verification of an asset in the case of the bank that you were going to be lending against. But it's also true for assets that you're going to hold. So, you know, having these audits are critically important. And what we do in Gold Money is we have two different auditing firms. One is a Big Four auditing firm, and the other one is a specialist bullion auditing firm. Every other month, going through the vaults and verifying that everything is working according to the way it should be working.
And they are set up so that they can tell the difference between an authentic bar and one that's not.
Yes, the gold that we use and silver is within what's called the chain of integrity of the London Bullion Market Association. So when a new bar that we add to the system comes into the vault, it has to always be within the chain of integrity, and we do certain inspections when it comes into the vault. These include verifying, you know, the weight, verifying the bar, you know, the history of the bars. When a bar is in chain of integrity, it's recorded as if it were a registered letter. Everyone who's touched that bar from the time it came out of the refinery is recorded in its registry. And basically the bottom line is that if a bar is ever found to be less weight than what it's supposed to be, the refinery who originally refined that bar ultimately stands behind it. So what you do is if you have a bar and it's not the weight it's supposed to be, you give it back to the person you bought it from, and he in turn gets it back to the person he bought it from until eventually it goes back to the refinery itself.
Okay. And one of the questions we have, which is a good one, is what is to prevent any storage facility from going bankrupt and the bankruptcy judge awarding the stored gold to the bankruptcy trustee as an asset to be liquidated to pay off creditors?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are really, you know, two things. First of all, there's the user agreement itself, which shows that the only claim the vault would have is the payment of fees. It has no other claim other than that. But the other important aspect is the actual legal system. You know, I'd mentioned earlier about Anglo-Saxon common law. It's quite clear within the legal system in London and Hong Kong, and also within Zurich or Switzerland, even though it's a different, you know, historical legal system, that when you're actually storing something in a specialized storage company, the storage company has no ownership rights over the property itself. It's like if you were going to put something in one of these self-storage places that you see around the country, the self-storage company only has access to the extent of any fees that you have that aren't paid, that are owed to the storage company, nothing over and above that.
And is it the same standards that apply in the States?
You mean in terms of the storage and the property rights?
I believe
it is in the States. You know, I'm not an expert on the U.S. legal system, and I've never really bothered looking into it because the Gold Money is not a U.S. company and not under U.S. jurisdiction. But I believe the legal roots of it are the same as that you would find outside the United States.
Well, one of the things we've all been watching, and I've gotten a series of questions about, is the discussion in the, or the description in the Wall Street Journal of the swaps with the Bank of International Settlements, BIS. First, the reporting was that it was with the central banks, and now that it's new email from Gatta saying no, it was with the commercial banks. But do you have any idea what in the world is going on and how it relates to the recent drop in prices?
Well, if the drop in prices is more from, I think, a psychological impact of people not knowing what's going on from the BIS announcements, you know, rather than, you know, any, you know, major impact or change. One of my, as you know, Catherine, because we've been talking about this many, many years now throughout the decade, to me, the most important thing is, does gold provide a usefulness to you when you own it, and what is its relative value? Those are the two things that we should be looking at. And gold still is useful because in an environment where banks are, insolvent and over-leveraged, and there are going to be more bank failures, and in an environment where the central banks of the world are printing money like there's no tomorrow, you want to have a money that preserves its purchasing power, and you want to have something like gold, which is the only money that doesn't have counterparty risk. So, you know, gold still has usefulness, and the important thing is that even though gold is at $1,200, it's still relatively undervalued. You know, it's still relatively cheap. What's happened is the dollar itself has become so debased that the price of gold is going up, but it's not going up at a rate faster than which the central bank is debasing the dollar. So, you know, the bottom line is that, we've been talking about this since, you know, gold was in the $320, $340 range, maybe even a little bit before that. Gold is still good value. It should still be accumulated. We're a long way yet before this bull market in gold is over. And, you know, people say to me, well, if I buy gold, how will I know when to sell it? You know, and immediately they're thinking, you know, January 1980, the benefit of hindsight, you know, the absolute peak, and, you know, they had only sold it at that moment. And I basically say that this time it's going to be pretty easy because you're not going to sell your gold, you're going to spend it. You know, I do really believe that gold is going to reemerge as currency. And when you can actually spend it once again in a variety of different ways as currency, its purchasing power is going to be at a maximum, at which point in time you then want to use the gold that you've been accumulating to make investments or perhaps purchase, you know, consumer items. But, you know, as I say, we're still in an environment where gold should be saved and accumulated because we're far from what I expect will be the maximum purchasing power of gold.
We, Franklin and I just updated the silver and gold payment calculator. Do you remember what that was? Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have seen that.
It's Franklin and I were talking. Well, Franklin, would you be willing to describe how you first introduced the idea of the calculator to me? Do you remember?
I'm not sure I remember the exact incident. I just remember that the whole goal is to get to enable people to use gold and silver as money. And they all complain and say, oh, God, well, I don't have any idea how to do that. I don't know what this is worth. How do I know I'm not getting cheated and all that sort of stuff? And, what we were trying to do was give them an easy way to figure out what their gold or silver was worth at that very moment. But you're thinking about some incident.
Well, no, it was just you said to me, because it seemed, you know, it was funny because I had been trying to give gifts to my cousins and get the kids all interested in gold and silver, and I was trying to make sure that I was fair and giving a sort of equivalent amount to each kid. And I realized that if the calculator existed, it would save me an enormous amount of money and time and struggle and unfairness. And I said, this is a genius idea. And so we put up the calculator. But the thing I wanted to let you know, James, is we've now got about 20 different currencies. It's not just the dollar. And our hope is it will help people do that. We'll start to use their gold and silver really to transact. And inspired by your iPhone app, we're hopefully by the end of the summer, we hope to have the calculator out in an iPhone app as well.
Oh, that's good
to
know.
I'm with you. I'd love to see people use it.
Yeah, you know, the technology is making it very easy to use gold and silver as currency. You know, the iPhone application is just one example of that, and I expect there to be more, you know, developments along those lines in the future. But the key, Kath, as you mentioned, is that the prices of goods and services should be calculated not only in terms of dollars, but also in terms of gold or you know, weights of gold or weights of silver, because only when you look at prices in terms of precious metals as well do you truly understand what's happening to the national currency. And the way I'd like to explain this is that I look at crude oil, for example. While the price of crude oil is going up, an ounce of gold still buys the same amount of crude oil it did 50 years ago. So it's not that the it's not that the price of crude oil is going up. It's that the purchasing power of the dollar is going down.
I think there's an even more important aspect of that, and that is, how do you know what your investments are worth if you have a currency that's not a standard of value? And the dollar is not a standard of value. I talk to people all the time who think their stock market investments are not doing well, but they're okay. They don't realize that since August of 99, their stocks have lost 80% against gold and 80% against silver. So
yeah, that's really a good point, Franklin.
So you're in a world where you can't calculate the value of anything. If the currency is constantly depreciating.
Of looking at it is that if you are up 10% in your stock portfolio at the end of the year, but the dollar is down 10% against the euro or down 10% against the value of gold, you can't really say that your portfolio increased by 10%. It may have increased in nominal dollar terms, but it hasn't increased in purchasing power terms. And it's really purchasing power that we should be using to measure wealth, and gold and silver are the two best standards by which to actually measure purchasing power.
Right.
One of the questions that came in, and I've been getting, because Franklin, you and I have been talking about the summer being traditionally a slow time or the low point for prices. James, why is summer always such a low point for precious metals? Is there a reason for it?
Well, there is some seasonality to the gold in the sense that the gold fabrication for monetary jewelry that's sold in Asia, and even the gold that's sold at Christmas presents or given away as Christmas presents or given away at Chinese New Year, those events tend to occur between October and February. The slow season for the buying for those fabricators tends to start around April, May, and it only starts picking up around July or August as they start to accumulate inventory to start fabricating to meet, that seasonal demand. So there is some seasonality to it, but it's not anything that you can necessarily bank on to occur year after year, because the supply of gold is 160,000 tons that exist in its above ground stock. And as a consequence, what really drives the gold price is not the supply, because it changes relatively little from year to year. What really drives the gold price is the demand for gold, whether people want to own physical gold or whether they want to own, some national currency. And I remember, for example, very well, 1982, the gold price doubled starting in the summer during the Mexican debt default that occurred back at that time. And, right now I think you have the potential for gold to go up during the summer, even though seasonally gold is normally pretty weak in the summer. We're only, $50 from the high. That could reach within a matter of a week or two. And once you break into new highs, I think the gold price could run quite far.
The floor always seems to be so much stronger than it did 5 or 10 years ago. When we start to drop, there's just too many people coming back in.
Yeah, it goes back to this physical demand thing. You have to recognize that there are two markets for gold. It's this paper market and the physical market. And at the end of the day, the physical market is much smaller than the paper market, You know, there have been estimates recently that there's 100 times more paper gold out there than there is physical gold. Whether it's that high or not, I don't really know. But, you know, even if it's 10 times more paper than physical, the paper market is huge. But at the end of the day, it's really the physical market that drives the gold price, because paper promises to deliver gold get questioned, and people actually move into the physical metal. And if you can't deliver against that paper promise, you know, that just creates more and more demand for physical. And that's basically
right.
What we're seeing now at the moment.
One other question that I wanted to ask, it's a good one. It's, please explain how gold works as a hedge in a deflationary scenario. It is much easier to explain how gold will maintain increased value in an inflationary scenario, but it's harder to explain in a deflationary. More of my friends seem to think we're now headed for a depression deflationary scenario like Japan has been in for the past 20 years.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about the deflation argument. I happen to believe that we're very, very close to hyperinflation. But, you know, even if I'm wrong and we do go into a deflation, the gold price may go down even, but the purchasing power of gold will go up because everything else will be going down even more. In other words,
right.
It goes back to this point I was making before and that Franklin was making. You need a standard by which to measure value. The dollar is no longer a good standard because it's a yardstick that's being constantly changed, but an ounce of gold is always unchanging. So the purchasing power of an ounce of gold will continue to increase in a deflation because of the usefulness that gold has as the only money that's not dependent on anyone's promise, the only money without counterparty risk. In a deflation like you had in the 1930s where banks were failing, the money supply was shrinking, promises were being broken, debts were being defaulted on, you want to avoid financial assets, you want to own tangible assets like gold, which do not have counterparty risk. So even in a deflation, gold will go up because its usefulness will increase. Because its useful increases, that increases the demand for gold. Increase of demand for gold will increase the purchasing power of gold or the value of gold. So gold, in my view, is going to go up regardless whether we have inflation or deflation. But, you know, I am clearly in the inflationary camp, probably the hyperinflationary camp.
And Franklin, where are you in that spectrum?
Oh, I think the deflation arguments are perfectly ridiculous. I think they're both ridiculous and short-sighted because anyone who makes the deflation argument in today's world has to ignore everything that's happened since 1933. I think I've told you this story, Catherine, but years ago I was talking to John Exter, who used to be the VP in charge of the Fed's gold operations in New York. And John was extremely kind to me and a wonderfully intelligent man, a great thinker, very honest. And we were talking about, you know, he went to Harvard at the end of the Depression. And, of course, so he as a young man, was exposed to all of the problems of the Depression. And I'll never forget, I was talking to him on the phone, and we were talking about that deflation, and he said, oh, my. His voice got real low. He says, oh, my, when that deflation takes hold, nothing will make it turn loose. And what I was hearing, I realized, I was hearing the experience of a whole generation of central bankers who had been taught that their greatest fear was deflation. Well, what has happened since then? The entire financial and monetary structure of the world has changed so that deflation cannot happen. They put in hundreds of automatic circuit breakers into the institutional framework of American finance and government to prevent deflation ever taking hold. In fact, to kick in at the time it takes hold. Now, so what I'm saying is there is an institutional bias to inflation built in so strongly that literally the monetary system and the government must inflate or die. They cannot stop inflating. They cannot pay off the government debt. They must keep inflating because all the money is borrowed into existence. And if they stop inflating, then they can't pay the interest that's due on the part that's already been borrowed into existence. So all of these arguments about deflation require that one be absolutely blind to the institutional and political changes that have happened in the last 80 years. And it's just not going to happen. Finally, add to that the known, the professed policies of the people in charge, like Bernanke. Go back and read his November 2002 speech. Everything that he said he would do there to, quote, fight deflation, he has done. Everything. So their answer is, look, the only weapon they have is inflation. That's it. Now imagine that your only weapon is a machine gun and thousands of enemy troops are coming over the hill. Are you going to shoot the machine gun? The answer is, of course you are. You're going to shoot it till the barrel melts down. And that's exactly
there's a wonderful, for those who are interested, there's a wonderful article that Robert Landis wrote in 2005, which I've linked to from the blog. It's called Gold. If you do a search on the blog for golden deflation, it will link to his article, and it addresses the sort of the case for gold and the fact that, you know, the reason, as James, as you said, that people are seeking gold is the because the other currencies are not trustworthy. It doesn't have the third-party counter. It doesn't have the third-party risk. It's quite good.
And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened in the 1930s, and why some people get confused about, you know, saying that we're going to have a deflation today. In the 1930s, the dollar was defined as a weight of gold, and as people started to question the value of the dollar or the bank where they had those dollars deposited, they moved out of paper into physical, and that's what actually caused the massive deflation of the 1930s. The dollar is no longer defined as a weight of gold. So, you know, the Federal Reserve is going to continue to print and print and print, and ultimately, I think, destroy the currency, destroy the dollar.
Well, I know, you know, I came from a world, I was a securities person, and I knew nothing about gold, and it was really you and Franklin who got me interested, and I started, you know, I bought coins and had a gold money account and started to deal with the volatility, which scared me to death until suddenly, and I can't even tell you what it was, I started thinking of my assets, I started measuring the value of my assets in ounces, as Franklin says, ounces, acres, and hooves instead of in dollars. And I found as soon as I could sort of psychologically and intellectually leave the dollar as a way of calculating assets, things got much clearer and much more simple. And yet I've never been able to unpack for someone else how to do that. When I see and talk with both of you, I can feel it. I know I'm talking to people who think that way, but, you know, so many of us are literally entrained to the dollar.
Yeah, it's like learning a second language in a certain way. And I often say that, you know, just like the international businessman who can speak several languages has the edge, today the international investor who can calculate purchasing power in terms of several different currencies also has the edge. And one of those currencies, of course, should be gold and also silver.
Right. Right. Well, there's one thing. The last topic I wanted to bring up is one that you know, the three of us go around and around and around. It's like walking around a bush looking for the duck. And that is sort of a combination of getting precious metals adapted and getting equity flowing in local economies. I mean, the way I look at the global economy is it just breaks down into thousands of local economies. And whether it's a community or it's a household, the assets of that place and the people in that place are being drained by a variety of things. And if you look at the unemployment that's happening in America and around the world, to me, the only way we can get that turned around is by seeing more equity circulate locally behind small business, community banks, a variety of different things. And right now, we're watching the equity sort of sucked up into Wall Street and not coming back around. But getting the equity flowing is, you know, it's like one side of a coin and the other side is sound money. And it's an awful lot to grapple with even when we sit and talk about it, let alone to have a whole society make that conversion. Because I can't imagine how you can price the equity honestly unless you've got a currency that you can trust to do so. But Franklin, you're grappling with the local economy, so maybe you can you can talk a little bit about how we make this happen.
Well, I'm pretty sure that James probably shares the opinion I'm about to voice, and that is there's a bittersweet aspect to selling gold and silver to people, because when you do, it's true that you're helping them preserve their capital, but you're also locking up the capital. Because gold, after all, if I have an investment in gold or an investment in silver, what is that? That's an investment in cash. And an investment in cash is, by definition, capital that is not being put to work in some sort of equity application. So we're tying up our money in gold and silver. Now, that's not the fault of investors. That's not my fault. That's not James's fault. That's the fault of the system, of the central banking system, that makes people have to do that to protect their wealth. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, how can we mobilize that locked up capital? And I remember quite well, James, you may not remember it, but back in 1991, I think you were already working on gold money, on the patent for gold money.
Yes.
But I wrote an article back then because I had a sort of epiphany. But thinking about the internet, thinking about what you were doing, and all of a sudden I realized that if you could perfect a system like that, if you could perfect a system like gold money, then within 2 years at the outside, that system could completely replace every national currency in circulation. Because the only reason that Gresham's law, which says that bad money drives good money out of circulation, the only reason it works is that the bad money has legal force behind it. It has a legal tender law behind it. Well, just suppose that people could, for instance, you know, put their money with gold money and then invest that money, invest those funds, and circulate it by means of gold money in their local community. Well, now they've taken that sequestered capital and put it to work, spending it between themselves and backing businesses in their local community. And that's the way it has to be done. Right now, though, for a person to borrow gold is a very dangerous undertaking, because the gold market is in a strong uptrend. So if I borrow 1,000 ounces of gold today, and I do it even at a very low interest rate, I'm going to have to earn quite a bit on that gold to make up for the market gain on the gold. So that's one of the things that makes a problem. But the more people who are dealing in gold and, as you described, thinking in terms of gold or silver, then the easier it becomes for us to work together, because they stop thinking in terms of paper money, and they're only thinking in terms of silver and gold. And even if there's a long-term price decline in terms of silver and gold, that's okay. That's all the better. That's better for all of us. But it's just a matter of breaking the circle and getting someone to start doing it, and that's what I keep encouraging people in local communities. Put up a double price list. Tell people, I'll take your silver and gold. You know, Justin, my son Justin is building a house, and he came to me this morning. He said, hey, I found just this outside siding I want for the house, and he described it to me and everything, and I said, well, how are you going to pay for it? And he said, well, the fellow wants gold. So, see, I mean, we've already got our little economy going, and he's buying his building materials for gold.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Franklin, because even if you calculate the local prices in terms of dollars or euros or wherever you happen to be, you can still actually make the payment in terms of gold, and you're enabling gold to circulate as a form of currency in that regard, even if you don't price your product in terms of gold. In other words, on any given day, you might buy $5,000 worth of building equipment and pay for it with gold. The next day, you might buy, farm feed, a couple hundred dollars to pay for that with gold. It's enabling gold to circulate, even if you're still pricing goods and services in the local community in terms of the national currency.
Right. And that really is the only exit strategy that I see for our economy. I mean, for the economic future of people in this country, they must have an exit strategy to get out of the paper money system. Otherwise, they're inevitably going to be taken down with it. I mean, you can't extricate yourself from it if that's the way you're paid, and all your wealth is denominated in that, and the currency that you use every day is denominated in it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. The other thing is that every individual has to have his own exit strategy. I mean, it would be absolutely wonderful if we had communities in which we worked that could rely on, which also shared all of our values in terms of, you know, using gold and silver as a form of currency. We've not yet reached that stage, though. So we each individually have to have, you know, a basic plan that protects ourselves and our families, you know, come what may.
Right.
And James, tell me, you're now living most of your time in Europe.
Yes.
Tell us, you know, one of the issues that Franklin and I are grappling with is the restrictiveness of the legal and regulatory structure here and the increasing arbitrary nature of it, although Franklin and I have dealt with more of the arbitrary than most people. And I think the question is, where are the jurisdictions globally that will allow these kind of sort of local economy adaptations to take place? Do you have a feel for that?
Yeah, you know, I think things are going to take place through the Internet. You know, I think communities will develop within the Internet as well as perhaps geographically. Interestingly,
right.
In Europe, there are a lot of local currencies developing in places like Germany because of people becoming worried about the euro. But they've not yet made the leap going back to, you know, gold or silver. You know, they're still thinking in local currency terms of some kind of paper currency. But I think that
Right. Ultimately
you're going to see people moving, you know, more closely to a form of gold or silver as a form of currency, particularly given the recent problems with the euro.
Well, also that, you know, Germany, Europe lived through the World War II, you know, the 30s and World War II. So I've always been amazed at how many former, you know, people who came here from Europe and live in the United States, I'll be in many groups, and they're the ones who remember back and talk about the importance of holding gold and silver. They have real historical memories of the criticality of it.
Yeah. Well, that's even true in my own family. My father was born in Austria before the First World War, and my grandfather came to the States with my father and his brothers and sisters in the early 1920s after the Austrian hyperinflation.
So what do you see, just as we close, what do both of you see between now and the end of the year for precious metals? Both, what do you see happening in terms of supply and demand? What do you see happening in terms of price? And where do you think the economy is going to go for the rest of the year?
Do you want me to go first on that one?
Okay.
Back in December when I did my forecast for this year, I felt that gold had the potential to go to $1,800 to $2,000, and that silver had the potential to go to $30 sometime during the course of this year. And it would be driven primarily because of a short squeeze where people are moving out of paper gold, paper silver, into physical gold and physical silver. I'm sort of sticking to that forecast. I still think those types of prices are possible before the end of this year. And in fact, I think they might come much more quickly than what people are thinking. You know, once we break above $1,250 on gold, which I do expect to have happen soon, and, you know, $20 on silver, silver, you know, could run very, very quickly, and so too could gold. So I think prices are going to go much higher. And with regard to the economy, you know, people are talking about a double dip. As I see it, we're still in the same dip. you know, there's been no recovery. Even the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the, you know, keeper of, you know, defining what a recession is, still says we're in a recession, and this has been the longest one since the end of the Second World War. So we're really in a depression. We're not in a recession.
And although we've had a massive injection of government money.
And it's done nothing in terms of creating real wealth. All
right.
It's done is added to the burden of debt. And the problem with the bust that we're in is we already have too much debt. You're not going to solve a debt problem with more debt. What we need is accumulated savings and not more debt. And, you know, the government typically is, you know, they're going in the wrong direction, and I think they're ultimately making the problem worse.
Franklin?
I don't think that the shoe has dropped yet. I don't think about double dip recessions. I think I agree with James. I think the worst is much is yet to come. You know, there's still people hanging around who think real estate is going to come back sometime soon. And there's the brunt of the Depression has not hit the South yet. I mean, you can drive around, you can see it, you can talk to people, and I don't know about other parts of the country, but I know about the South. It's not hit here, not like it has in Ohio or Illinois, places like that, Michigan, because we haven't lost the jobs that they have. My target for the end of the year for gold is about $1,375 and about $30 on silver. I hope it goes to $1,800. I'll be a happy man if it does. But I can't see that. I've learned, however, though, that James, you have the ability to say things that sound completely outrageous, and then in about 6 months, I turn around and say, "How did he know that?"
It's, I guess, luck more than experience. But, you know, the main thing, Catherine, is we really shouldn't focus on the price so much. We really should focus on something's usefulness and its relative value. And I think that's the key. You know, gold is still undervalued. It still has a lot of usefulness. Same thing for silver. And I think the purchasing power of both metals is going to continue to rise in the future, simply because the dollar is no longer what it used to be. The dollar is no longer as good as gold. It's just some, you know, paper aberration in monetary history that is continuing to be eroded by bad decisions by policymakers in Washington.
Right. On price, I'm much closer to Franklin, but I agree with what we've all said, which is everybody needs an exit strategy to get it out of paper and into tangibles. And that's the bottom line. And you know, and I think the time is running out. If you've been delaying doing that, the time is running out. Now is the time to move forward with all deliberate speed. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. James, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, thank you for everything you're doing with Gold Money. Can I mention where I'm going to be tomorrow?
In Jersey.
Yes. I'm finally going to get to see the Gold Money headquarters. I'm excited.
And we're looking forward to it as well, you know, and we'll welcome you there, give you a chance to, you know, kick the tires and have a look around and meet all of the key people. So I wish you well on your trip.
I always, when I work with people years and don't meet them, it's always really wonderful to finally meet the person and, you know, in real life person. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Coming up next week, we have Bob Sullivan from MSNBC on identity theft. And then July 22nd, there's a Salieri Report. Dr. Nick Begich from Earth Pulse on HARP. Lots of interest in what is HARP and how does it work. So until next week, just remember, don't worry if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one, and it needs to be one based on tangible assets. So good night and good luck.